Welcome to Telling Tales, a program devoted to the spoken word. I'm Ms. G. Today, Gustavus writer Kim Hee Cox reads a selection from his book, The Ice That Started a Fire, a biography of John Muir in Alaska. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the words of Kim Hee Cox.
My name is Kim Hee Cox. I live in Gustavus, over next to the entrance to Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve. I'm a freelance writer and photographer, musician, and conservationist. Writing is a gift. It's a privilege. I write because I have something to say, not because just to say something. I think that's important. I write because I'm a storyteller. I enjoy the freedom of self-expression. And I also live in a free society, and I think writers are very important to challenge authority, to raise questions other people might not raise, to make people think. And thoughts are important. Thoughts lead to action, and action, if you think about it, action leads to ideas and habits, and that leads to character, and character leads to legacy and destiny. It's great to be a writer, to take your thoughts and to work really hard, develop a craft and put them down on paper and express yourself as cleanly and lyrically as you can. It's fun. It's a challenge, and it's really nice to be able to reach people who say later to you, thank you for your story. Thank you for your book, your article. It really helped bring clarity into my own life and to make some decisions in my own life and make me think about things I hadn't thought about before. Especially in Alaska, where there's lots of important issues at hand. Alaska is the Africa of America, and there's a lot going on here that is important. And so to be a writer in Alaska right now, on the cusp of the new century, is exciting to me. I'm interested in changing the world in terms of our relationships with each other and our relationships to the natural world and how we treat nature and have a deeper regard for nature. Maybe, for example, treasure fresh water more than gold, trees more than timber. Come to think of a new relationship with the larger world, that it's not just here for our taking. That's a long journey, a long, winding road that we're on. The human relationship with a larger than human world, with nature. So I write a lot about that relationship, man and nature relationship. That's exciting. It's a great place to be in Alaska in that regard, to write about that. To get my writing started, I look at what's out there. What's being said? What's inspiring me? What's turning me on? What are other people talking about? And I think, okay, how can I contribute to that? And say something that's not been said before and say it in a new and refreshing way. I try to use humor. I try to use style a lot, self-deprecation, maybe a little sarcasm, different points of view if I'm writing fiction. And I always, at the end of each day when I'm writing, I try to leave my writing on the cusp of something exciting. Maybe I'm a little too tired to move forward, but I know exactly what I want to say next, on the beginning of a new paragraph. But if I'm tired at that time, I'll let it go for the next day so I can be out of the blocks real quickly the next day and know right away what I want to say. I used to do a lot of writing that would accompany both an essay form and long captions photography, and you want to compliment the photograph. You don't want to compete with it. And maybe instead of specifically saying what the photo is, maybe tell a story that just implies the photo and accommodates the photo in a nice sort of a way. So you can speak directly to the photograph, or you can tell a story that complements the photograph. More recently, in the last several years, I'm not doing so much photography anymore, and I'm writing biography and novels based in Alaska. Most writers need to have a day job. It's difficult to make a living as a writer. My day job for the last 20 years has been to sail around the world on expedition cruising ships with Lindblad Expeditions and National Geographic Expeditions, going to Arctic Norway, Europe, the Sea of Cortez in Mexico. I've made 40 trips to Antarctica, trips in British Columbia and Alaska, and that's a pretty sweet deal. I I read some of my writing on the ships. I teach photography. Work with a great group of people here. Soon I'll be going to Arctic Norway to see polar bears. It's a sweet arrangement. What attracts people to my work, what attracts them to Alaska, is what I call ice nostalgia because of climate change. I think many people want to see ice. 20, 30, 40 years ago, they wanted to see bears and whales, and they still do. But now they are really keen on seeing ice, big bodies of ice, large tidewater glaciers. These people coming to Alaska is, I think, really refreshing and invigorating for them to see these tidewater glaciers. Those, some of them in Glacier Bay are still quite robust because the catchment basins for the glaciers where the snow falls, the elevations are very high, like 8,500, 9,000, 10,000 feet. Whereas a catchment basin for a glacier where the snow would be falling, is if it's only 4,500 feet, like maybe the Juneau ice field, then the glaciers are going to shrink back. And so they can learn a lot about glaciers. They can see glaciers that are holding still and maybe even slightly advancing, and that gives them heart and hope in today's world. So that's exciting to share that with people, although it's incumbent upon me, I believe, to tell them about what's really going on in the atmosphere. For example, over the last 800,000 years, we've averaged between 180 and 280 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. And today we're at 393 and going up 2 parts per million every year. So it's a radical shift, and that's part of what I write about. But I try to write about it in a engaging way, embedded in story, and being as lyrical and stylish as I can. And it's a challenge.
You're listening to Telling Tales, today featuring Gustavus writer Kim Hecox, offering his thoughts on the craft of writing.
I'd like to read to you from my forthcoming book, The Ice That Started the Fire, a biography of John Muir in Alaska. This is the prologue called The Gospel of Glaciers. Was it madness? A death wish of some kind? The 5 Tlingit Indians said little as they glanced at the quiet missionary sitting among them and stabbed the sea with each stroke, paddling their cedar canoe northwest into iceberg-filled waters where no man dared to go this time of year. No man unless he was a seal hunter. No man until this other man came along, their second passenger, the one up front who scribbled notes and nibbled on dry crusts of bread. No hunter at all, more of an observer, charismatic in his own way, a good listener, a real talker, this scrappy, bearded Muir, his blue-gray eyes drinking up the country. Half wise elder, half wondrous child, he seemed interested in everything. Shouldn't somebody say something, insist on turning around? They could all die, be overturned and drowned by Kushtaka, the unforgiving land otter man, a Tlingit legend, or any other Gundakrit, sea monster, and never be found. Onward, Muir compelled them, onward to the glaciers, he would say. Never mind the wind or the rain or the ice or the cold. A dour sky pressed down, rain occasionally lashed them. Pieces of floating ice, calved from tidewater glaciers up ahead, tapped an ancient, forgotten language against the canoe. Ice everywhere and little sign of life in a land that was once rich in salmon, berries, forests, and firewood. Most of that gone now, the land's richness and bounty having been destroyed by an advancing glacier that evicted the Tlingits and entombed the bay for many generations, in some places swallowing entire mountains. Only recently had the glacier begun a dramatic retreat, unveiling a vast, raw, woodless, ice-chafed land in somber shades of gray. A foreboding place. Summer was over. It was yais, autumn time, the month Americans called October. Soon it would snow, and the cold carved moon would turn brittle in the tangle of winter stars. The glaciers would grow still under deep blankets of snow, and darkness would strike all moisture from the air. Stillness would pound the land silent and stretch all the way to the Arctic. John Muir was 41 that autumn, engaged to be married the next spring to the only daughter of a prosperous California fruit merchant. With her reluctant blessing, "Do not be vexed with me," she wrote him. He had come to Alaska to see glaciers firsthand, to find out how they worked and shaped the land, how they carved rock and moved mountains, all to help buttress his theory that glaciers, not catastrophic downfaulting, had shaped his beloved Yosemite Valley and much of the Sierra Nevada, the mountains Muir called the Range of Light. While he often rode in the front of the canoe, the other white man, S. Hall Young, a Presbyterian missionary, rode farther back. If anybody were to argue for turning around and getting them out of there, it would not be Young. In Muir's company, he was a follower. He had met the effervescent California naturalist more than 3 months before, in early July, in Fort Wrangell, some 200 miles by water to the south, and found in him a man to be admired, not questioned. It would be up to Toyatte, the Tlingit chief and captain of the 35-foot canoe, to bring this adventure to an end. But Toyatte might have seen in Muir the same thing Young saw. They pushed on. Camped that night on the west side of what we know today as Glacier Bay, near Charpentier Inlet, with Muir off climbing a mountain by himself, the Tlingits huddled around a wet, smoky campfire and confided in Reverend Young. This Muir must be a witch of some kind, a Naxwiati, to be so crazy happy in this lean, hard country. Why does he climb mountains in such terrible weather? To seek knowledge, Young told them. The year was 1879. Across the continent and in Western Europe, industrious men went about the exciting business of progress. For 10 years, a railroad had spanned the young United States from Boston to San Francisco, and every year more tracks spidered their way over mountains, deserts, and plains, obliterating great distances, said one historian, to make the land safe for commerce and cows. No task was too great, no vision too absurd. Thomas Edison invented the incandescent light bulb to make cities shine at night. Andrew Carnegie introduced the steel blast furnace. The first canned fruits and meats would soon appear in 1880, along with the world's first electrostatic generator. Out west, camps became forts. Forts became towns. Towns became cities, and cities grew. Custer and his men had been massacred only 3 years ago and quickly avenged, thank God. America must be harnessed and put to work, people said. Natural capital must be turned into consumable products. Materialist expansion must sweep away misery and social inequity and put us on the road to universal abundance. It was the right thing to do, our destiny, written in books, newspapers, the Bible, and the stars. To argue against such improvements was a fool's errand. Yet the great American novelist and Muir contemporary, Mark Twain, was beginning to do just that. An eloquent gadfly on the sticky paper of progress, he would be Muir's soul brother in more ways than one, noting that Shakespeare created Hamlet's fool for a reason, to express a wisdom others did not. Twain and Muir, only 3 years apart in age, would both live three-fourths of a century. In that time, from their births in the 1830s until their deaths in the second decade of the 1900s, America would transform itself from an agrarian democracy into an industrial oligarchy that brought with it feasts of conspicuous consumption, an era that Twain called the Gilded Age. He further used a term not unfamiliar to Muir, citified, an epithet, Twain noted, which suggests the absence of all spirituality and the presence of all kinds of paltry materialisms and mean ideals and mean vanities and silly cynicisms. Alaska would be to John Muir what the open ocean was to Mark Twain, or the mountains of Assisi in central Italy had been to St. Francis, his wildest dream, a place of healing distances and deep silence and blessed meditation. While California was Muir's home, Alaska would be his dream, his escape, incomprehensible in its beauty, vastness, and unforgiving ruggedness, just the way he liked it. Over the next 20 years, 1879 to 1899, Muir would make 7 journeys to Alaska. In that time, he would evolve from a self-taught naturalist, glaciologist, and ecologist into a best-selling author and unapologetic preservationist, America's preeminent fang in the fight against irresponsible industry and runaway development. "Nothing dollarable is safe," he would say, and so Alaska inspired him to battle the universal conceit that nature was put here for us to use as we please. Traveling by canoe into the icy wildness of Glacier Bay in October was not madness, as the Tlingits might have thought. For John Muir, it was a joy, a revelation. Madness was out there, all right, but not in the temples of wild nature. Any student of natural history could see that nature was beautiful and brutal. Witness how the swallow skims the river and catches the bug on the wing, how the cougar takes down the deer, how the eagle snaps the duck. It's a lethal, bloody affair. But none of these animals create a machine to magnify their killing. None invent an economy that's never full. None create corporations that at all costs, even the loss of dignity, must forever grow. It was a simple matter of how you saw the world and your place in it. Where others found gold, John Muir found glaciers. Where they saw timber, he saw trees. Where they sought profit, P-R-O-F-I-T, he sought a prophet, P-R-O-P-H-E-T, an expression of God's greatest creation, nature, the wisest of all teachers, not to be chopped up and sold, but left as it was, held in deep regard. Never mind utility. Wild nature had value in and of itself, what he called mountain nourishment. This book is an exploration into what made John Muir who he was and how Alaska shaped him, specifically its glaciers, and how he shaped us. To Muir, glaciers had character, power, and grace. They were alive and deserving of our deepest understanding and respect. In their presence, he became a druid of sorts, a Celtic priest, or more accurately, the Johann Wolfgang von Goethe of his day, a holistic thinker who challenged the modern scientific revolution to find a balance between the rational, quantitative mind and the intuitive, qualitative mind. Muir could have done this with wolves, or bears, or with flowers, as Goethe had done, but he did it with glaciers, cold rivers of ice, that appeared static but in fact moved dynamically over the land and shaped everything around them, making them a perfect piece of symbolism in today's warming world. "The only thing that counts is that which can be counted," said Galileo 300 years before Muir. Together with René Descartes, Isaac Newton, and others, Galileo gave us our modern scientific revolution, our age of reason, the triumph of the rational mind. And while he and his brilliant contemporaries were right, they were also wrong. They separated us from nature, rather than made us participants in nature. They made us clever and powerful, but not wise. Muir was a revolutionary of another kind, who said there's much more to good science and right livelihood than connecting data and dissecting frogs. There's a deeper meaning than conventional analytical reason. Experiment is not enough. Good science also requires experience, a deep knowing and sense of wonder that comes from being out there, barefoot in the meadow, alone on the ice, naked in the storm. When we try to pick out anything by itself, Muir would write, we find it hitched to everything else in the universe. Galileo and Descartes had rational knowledge. Muir had intuitive wisdom, acquired from the smallest flower and the largest glacier. He didn't merely learn about the natural world, he learned from it. He went out there and slowed down and listened until his intuitive mind could dance with his rational mind. By doing so, he could feel the qualities of things around him. This enabled him to widen his circle of compassion. And with this wisdom and compassion, with this deep sense of the sacred, he would begin to write about the natural world and campaign for its defense while the rest of America hypnotized itself with 1,000 clever devices that consumed nature wholesale. There was nobody else like him. John Muir popularized geology, especially its young subset science, glaciology. He gave America a new vision of Alaska and a new and brighter vision of itself. He reordered our priorities and contributed to a new scientific revolution picked up a generation later by Aldo Leopold and Rachel Carson and championed today by E.O. Wilson, Carl Safina, Stephen Harding, and others. He was a gentle rebel, a talkative hermit, a distant son of the Scottish Enlightenment, inspired by ice. You cannot stare into the eyes of a glacier. It's not a wolf. But you can stare into its face, its tidewater terminus, a stunning, imposing ice wall rising from the sea, 200 feet high, deeply weathered, a threshold where the glacier ends and everything else begins, where blue siracs collapse into the ocean, and primal thunder booms down rock-ribbed inlets. In rare cases, the glaciers might advance. Most often, though, in today's changing world, they retreat. They shrink back and die. Sometimes they hold steady, as a few do in Glacier Bay. John Muir found inspiration in these blue ice faces, as if the glaciers, like wise elders, had stories to tell and warnings to give. To this day, he challenges us to see what he saw and do what he did, and more. He became our patron saint of flowers and birds, glaciers and bears, wilderness and wolves, by far the most vocal preservationist in a young nation hell-bent on making money. He became our corrective lens, our better conscience. He spoke for the wild places and gave them credible value. He showed us in Alaska as a new world's new world, a place to unmap and remap what remained of America and our destiny in it. On his last trip north, as an elder member of the prestigious 1899 Harriman, Alaska expedition, financed by Edward H. Harriman, president of the Union Pacific Railroad, one of the richest men in America, Muir would quip, "I'm more rich than Mr. Harriman. Why? Because I have all the money I could ever want, and he does not." The glaciers Muir found in Alaska were larger and more dynamic and robust than anything he had ever seen or imagined. They were his abacus, his new ruler and measuring stick that made all remaining wild lands down south seem small and vulnerable. They were his metaphor, flowing through the land, yes, and through his open heart and mind, through time and events and all things, until he transcended the mentality of separateness and reductionism and experienced man and nature as one, the wholeness outside, continuous with a healthy inside. These great ice rivers, tumbling down mountains and into the sea, birthed icebergs and blended as a single essence with the snow, which in turn, Muir wrote, blended with the invisible breath of the sky. They awakened in him what he called the gospel of glaciers, an awareness and red-hot activism that would carry him through the rest of his days and consume him in his later years and give birth to the modern American conservation movement. They were the ice that started a fire.
You're listening to Telling Tales, today featuring Gustavus writer Kim Hecox offering his thoughts on the craft of writing.
What I use in my toolbox as a writer is I like to move back and forth between different points of view. I like to back away and do an overview scope of America at the time. If I'm writing about John Muir in a canoe in Alaska, I also want to know what's going on with Andrew Carnegie and Thomas Edison. I like to point out how different parts of the world are moving in radically different directions to create tension within a story. So it's good to put the reader in a canoe in Alaska in 1879, but then back away and as if you're rising up into space and look down at America as a whole and create that tension. I think that's very important. I also like to try to give the Tlingit point of view as much as I can. And what must they be thinking of this Presbyterian missionary and John Muir in the canoe? So it's good. It's called POV, point of view. It's good in any storytelling, I believe, to try to move back and forth between different points of view. Not too many points of view, but some to create that tension so that a single character in a story is held in different regard by different participants in that story. That creates good tension, and people like tension. It helps to move the story along. I like Naomi Klein and Bill McKibben very much because they're addressing climate change in a very aggressive, powerful way. They're waking America up. I like the novels of Cormac McCarthy and David James Duncan for their use of language. Just the sentence structure is so magnificent. Sherman Alexie, writing about Native Americans. I love Mark Twain, of course. I think he's the greatest of all American writers for his self-deprecation. I remember once he was an newspaper reporter in Hawaii, he went to Kilauea volcano. He said, "The smell of sulfur is strong, but not unpleasant to a sinner." That's such a beautiful little line, because he's basically putting himself down. He's saying he's no different from the rest of us, that we're all sinners to some degree. Him too. He's not better than anybody else. And let's not fool ourselves by trying to rise above the crowd. And I just think that's a magnificent piece of writing. It's a great piece of humor. So I love Mark Twain. Edward Abbey, the essayist and novelist from the desert Southwest, he really turned me on when I was in my 20s for his beautiful use of language and his wonderful sense of humor. In Alaska, I admire many writers. Lynn Schooler, Nick Jans in Juneau, Sherry Simpson, formerly from Juneau, Seth Kantner up in the Arctic, John Straley over in Sitka. It's such a wonderful community of writers in Alaska. It really feels good to be a part of that family. We all look out for each other and we encourage each other. It's great. In my writings on John Muir in Alaska, I've noticed that most of the major biographies of John Muir, and there are several good ones, give very little time to his adventures in Alaska. And you consider that Alaska was the wildest place he ever experienced, and wildness is what fed him. And so I felt it was important to develop a book that really explored John Muir in Alaska, how he changed Alaska, and Alaska changed him. And what I really want writers to take away from it is that exchange, the importance of Alaska to Muir and Muir to Alaska. He basically changed the national image of Alaska from that of Seward's Folly, Seward's Icebox in 1867, when Secretary of State masterminded the purchase of Alaska from Russia under the Johnson administration, to 12, 15 years later, John Muir's up here, 1879, 1880, writing about Alaska in Overland Monthly magazine. People are going, wow. He's saying, this is not an icebox. This is a place of wonder and beauty and magnificence. And within 4 years of Muir being up here, you've got steamships carrying 290 passengers to see the Muir Glacier in Glacier Bay. It's being labeled the eighth wonder of the world in 1884. So he really did have a strong impact on the future of Alaska back then in the 1880s.
You've been listening to Telling Tales, today featuring Gustavus writer Kim Hee Cox reading the prologue from his book, The Ice That Started a Fire, a biography of John Muir in Alaska. This program was produced by Jeff Brown in the studios of KTOO-FM in Juneau, Alaska. I'm Ms. G. Thanks for tuning in.